live from the foot of the Little Mermaid statue in the Copenhagen Harbor, and brought to you by Lego. Play well. I'm Delmon.
And I'm Alicious.
And this is EQ2 Talk. This is episode number 29, and we are recording on August 6, 2011. And Allie, why still don't we have theme music?
Well, Del, I found out that Soylent Green is people.
You know, I was having some Soylent Green the other day, and they are like potato chips. I couldn't stop at one, and before I knew it, I had eaten the whole bag. Okay, but enough about eating people. Allie, this week we have a huge guest star with us, a giant among the EverQuest 2 community. Everybody knows this guy unless you've been living under a rock. Let us bring on Theldon from EQ2 Wire.
Welcome.
Good evening.
We wanted to talk with you a little bit about what you're doing over there on EQ2 Wire and some of your opinions and takes on some of the things we see going on right now in the EverQuest 2 universe. So can you give us a little bit of a background into how you got going on EQ2 Wire?
Well, I went to Fanfare in 2008, and that was that's when we found out about the Guild Halls and the Shadow Odyssey. And, you know, I installed the WordPress app on my website and put it on my iPhone, and I said, okay, I'll start up a little site about Fanfare, and I'll just, you know, I'll post some screenshots and some information. Like, wait a minute, okay, people need to read this. So I logged into the game while I was there and said, okay, I'm going to be posting some stuff and go check out this website. And it took off from there. And after Fanfare, I had no plans to keep the site going. But then I kept getting requests like, you got to post more stuff. Like, there's more stuff. And I noticed that a lot of other EQ2 fan sites, which had fulfilled that role of news and commentary, were fading away as people had moved on from the game. So there was a window, and I took that opportunity.
It's hard to believe it's only been a few years. I feel like Wire has been around forever. Maybe it's just because that's kind of where I go to get all my news rather than sifting through all the forums.
Well, it's funny you mention that because that's kind of my unofficial motto. It says we read the EQ2 forums and EQ2 flames so you don't have to.
I like it. And a lot of it you don't want to read. I mean, there's a lot of junk out there. The forums are sort of filled with a lot of white noise, but you do a really good job of distilling down all of that massive amounts of information and give people sort of the important key points that come out of all of that. I'm just wondering how you get all that done. Do you actually read everything? Do you really keep up on every forum out there?
I used to read all of the forums, and since then I've kind of backed off of that, and I read specific forums, specific areas of the forums. Looking for anything that would affect people's gameplay or that might have some, you know, upcoming ideas or information about the future of the game.
Other than the SOE forums, where else are you drawing some of your information from?
Okay, I start with the EQ2 dev tracker. So that's all of the posts by Hrothgar and Smokejumper. I recommend anyone read that anyway. Then I look at the update notes. I look at the test update notes, and I pull those off of the patchers. I don't actually use Twitter myself, but I'm following a lot of people who post about EQ2 who might have some news or a different angle on things or some breaking news about it. After that, I start digging in the forums to see if there's anything I've missed.
That sounds like almost like a full-time job, but it's still just a hobby for you, right?
Yeah, I'm not making any money on EQ2 Wire. So I probably spend about an hour and a half a day reading the forums and trying to keep up. It's a lot of information, a lot of posts as well.
Now, you're not necessarily in U.S.-based time. So how does the time difference from you versus San Diego affect how you get stuff posted?
Well, that's actually been a real problem ever since I moved here. You know, I'm 9 hours ahead of Pacific, of SOE time, and they have a tendency to post news in the afternoon. So a lot of times it's after I've already gone to sleep. So if you see a lot of posts at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, it's because I've had my first cup of coffee sometimes, and I'm reading all this something that broke in the afternoon at Sony time.
Well, I have to say, you do an amazing job at that because, you know, your tagline being breaking news, it always seems breaking to me. So I think folks are a little duped sometimes that you're not in San Diego time and getting that stuff immediately as it happens, because it does post instantly for us, and I think that's great.
Yeah, when during the downtime, Dell and I think we're both just like constantly refreshing your page just to see if there's anything else going on. What else is happening? Is there any update?
I was looking everywhere for information on that. I mean, I was hitting people up. You know, I found that actually someone emailed me a tip, and I do get tips periodically. Someone sent me a tip that was from the San Diego newspaper. It was not an ETA. It was a non-ETA. It was a, we won't be up before so-and-so day. So I posted that. But since before that, we hadn't had any time estimate at all.
Yeah, that was tough. I do remember, like Elliot was saying, sitting there clicking it like every 5 minutes as if that was my tracker to whether or not EverQuest 2 was going to come back.
That's why my hits were so high. Actually, my hits during the downtime, my hits were higher than Fanfare, if you can believe that.
I was just going to ask you that. I would imagine that to be the case, that because there was nothing coming out of the SOE domains, we had nothing. And the only place to start looking was Facebook and EQ2Wire, really, for me.
And that drove me nuts, having to read Facebook to try to keep up with that. You know, and I did send an email through PR, through Brass, and then through PR with some questions. I said, you know, completely leave out the security, leave out all of the legal questions, and I just have some questions. What have you guys been working on? What's the mood been like at the office while all of this is going on? Is this going to affect the schedule of anything that's coming up? And I was just trying to say, look, you know, yes, this terrible thing has happened, but you know, the developers are still going into the office every day. They're still working. Are they getting more work done now that they don't have to read the forums? Are they getting less work done because there's not that input, that interactivity? I tried to get answers to that and didn't really work out. But I posted all the news that I could get my hands on.
You mentioned getting tips from readers or other people. And there's something I've noticed. You seem to follow sort of journalistic ethics. You give the correct citation to quotes. You identify the source of thoughts and ideas if they weren't yours. I'm just curious if you have a background in journalism at all.
It's always been important to me to have the quotes and to know where the information came from. I don't have a journalistic background, but I've always felt if people are going to keep coming back to the site, you know, it can't just be made up out of whole cloth, and it can't just be, I heard from so-and-so.
Well, I think Dell and I both like the fact that you, when you have commentary, you indicate that it's commentary.
I try to put it into its own section. I try to put a little headline and say, look, this is not a press release. This is not some official information. This is just my thoughts.
Was that your original plan when you launched Wire? Was it more just the news, or were you going to include commentary? Did that sort of evolve out of what you were doing?
Originally, it was just going to be news. Then I started adding in the commentary. It was just completely, I guess you would say, I was strongly motivated. And so I started adding that to it as well.
Well, I have to say, I do enjoy your commentary because it's based in fact. And it's not just the, pardon the fun, the ravings of a mad lunatic. And you can get some of that on the forums, and we all do it at times, arms flailing, pitchforks, and torch gathering. But your discussions make me pause and think sometimes and put down my pitchfork and think there's a little bit more to this than just the knee-jerk reaction, and you don't seem to do that a lot, and I give you credit for that.
I don't know if you know, but I used to talk to Kiera quite often on the EQ2 community team. She talked to all the fan sites. And So I would tell her, you know, I'm thinking of writing an article about so-and-so. What do you think? Or am I completely off base? And as well as other players and other readers, I would show them some of these articles. So what you saw was not always, this came out of my brain, I wrote it, and that's what you see. You know, I did say, look, how do the developers feel about this? How is this perceived? I didn't want to just have one opinion.
It is nice to have that sounding board.
I miss it. I miss having someone at SOE say, am I completely off base? Or are you guys, is there a fix around the corner that I don't need to write some long, nasty article saying, oh, SOE is the devil and they're going to do this. And there's this thing on test, which is just terrible. I would have a reality check for anything that I was going to post. And, you know, I do also have a habit. I'm sure people have noticed. I have a habit where I'll post something and I'll immediately hit edit. And then start going through and fixing some things or maybe changing a word or two. I don't rewrite it, but I'm never satisfied with an article that I've posted.
Do you find that you have to go back and edit a lot? Because sometimes SOE is not so forthcoming with information. So you'll start down one path, and then, like you say, the next day out comes the fix for that.
Well, in that case, I'll do a separate little box at the top that says, like, update this new information. I don't want articles to be so fluid that every day it's a completely different article, because then it wouldn't be useful.
I have noticed that in your commentary a lot of times, it does feel like you just reached into my brain and put exactly how I feel into words, and I didn't realize it until I read it. So I kind of feel like you have a good sense of who the players are, who your readers are, and the direction of things, maybe more than people realize.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's actually taken a long time to find my own voice in the writing of the site. You know, I used to post articles, and I would look for people's opinions on the forums, and I would use different quotes to make a point or to spell out a point. And I've shifted away from that. And that's not because there aren't great ideas out there. There aren't great commentaries out there. Again, I have an opportunity to express myself as someone who trades skills, groups. I raided for a solid year, solo questing. You know, I try to play the entire game so that I don't lose perspective on one specific type of gameplay.
That actually was going to be one of my questions, is working on EQ2Wire, I was wondering if it's affected how you play the game.
You know, I raided TSO, which was a pretty punishing expansion for raiding, because everything seemed to be focused on single points of failure. Everything came down to one player running to the right place at the right time, curing the right thing, or the whole thing failed. And you had a lot of hurt feelings. You had a lot of infighting. So after that year of raiding TSO, I actually took several months off of the game. I tell you, it's quite a challenge to write a site about a game that you aren't really playing all that much. And so I did bring in some other writers, and I tried different things out. I read the dev tracker constantly, but I wasn't really playing it. And I felt bad about that, because I'm writing a site about a game that I wasn't playing all that much. And so last fall, I really started to get back into it fully. And then with Velius, I'm 100% back into the game.
Did you feel that your passion for playing just wasn't there?
Part of it also was in the process of moving to Copenhagen from the U.S. You know, raiding, I've heard this from a lot of people. If you're raiding in a situation that's not a good situation, if you're brought into a raid guild to fill a slot and you don't make friends quickly, then it really turns into a what feels like an unpaid part-time job. And I was like, I'm putting all these hours in. We're not progressing because we kept losing people or different things going on within. It was a frustrating situation. I had to walk away from it.
You mentioned bringing in other writers. You have a sort of partner in crime, I guess, Death Dealer. I'm just wondering how that came about. How did you get another writer? And maybe you have more than one. And how long has he been with you at Wire?
Well, he contacted me April of last year, and he's been great. Sometimes I'll be out of town, and he'll cover any kind of major news that comes in. But that's really hasn't been the main thing he's done. The main thing he's done is Death Dealer's Dungeon. He does his own thing. He does his own pieces. Sometimes it's a viewpoint on the game. Sometimes it's a guide for players about grouping, how to set up a group, how to set up a raid. It's you know, he writes articles as like a stepping stone to get into more serious grouping or raiding. It's really been great. And I do have other writers that I've auditioned, and I'm still looking. If anybody wants to write for EQ2Y or send me an email, you know, I'm looking for different ideas. I don't want it to just be a repeat of what I'm doing.
You know, that's interesting because I think that is one piece of the EverQuest 2 community that kind of is missing is quality guides. The XAM and the Wiki, they present very good walkthroughs and database feed dumps, to say the least. But there's not a lot of good where things fit in progression and how to build that raid and what are the best spells. There's not a lot of that that's centrally located. And it's scattered amongst a lot of various different forums, posts, and different hodgepodge websites. And that's one thing that I think is really missing. I have enjoyed Death Dealer's his adornment guide and whatnot and those sort of things, and certainly your own. These are the tiered progressions for a particular expansion. These are the zones, and these are the yellows, the reds, and the greens kind of thing. Because that's something that's, I think, missing. And, you know, when an expansion launches and you land in that new area, that new zone, you have no idea where to go next. Do you walk into the x6 raid zone by accident because it happened to be the door on your left? So I certainly enjoy and appreciate those pieces, and I would always love to see more of them.
I definitely want to do more of that. You know, one of the things I did when I started playing Velius is, okay, there's these factions. What is the reason to do these different factions? What are the benefits? So I did an article on that. And you know, XAM is putting in a lot of hard work. I mean, if you looked at XAM a couple of years ago, there was a lot of disparate information. They've really spent a lot of time putting it together into guides and one page which has links to everything. I think XAM's strength is in the solo quests and the trade skills and the live events. That's really their strength. They're not doing a lot into the grouping and the raiding. And that's something that I want to try to fulfill because that's an important part of the game.
How did those sort of tools and guides evolve? Like that adornment selector and the armor guide, is it just a need that you saw, or were those things requested by readers?
You know, there's a great adornment site out there, adornments.hobo.net, but she had not updated it since Sentinel's Fate. And when Velius came out, it's like, okay, is it going to get updated? So Death Dealer and I talked by email, and I told him about some things that are coming up, and we brainstormed some ideas. What tools could we make for EQ2 players to use? And the first one we came up was the adornment calculator. He put in all the hours on that. It has every level 90 adornment in the game. That's player made, Sentinel's Fate yellow, Velius yellow and red, war runes, even the adornments from the Swords of Destiny signature quest. Well, the armor guide grew out of wanting to have an itemization article. And so I looked at what are the rewards for grouping, or what are the heroic armor sets from Velius? And there was a lot of complexity to it. I mean, I talked to different people, and they weren't really sure how the Rygor armor worked. And people were even more confused about how the Drunder armor worked. And so I sat down and started writing this article, and I had to consult people on tests. I had to consult people in crafting channels. I had to look items up. I had to double-check a lot of things. It took me a lot of research to write that article. And so when I saw how much work it was to write it, I knew it would be helpful to players because they had to be as puzzled as I was.
Definitely. It's more than an article. To me, it's sort of like a main staple on my browser. I just kind of leave it there. It's more of a tool at this point, or a reference guide almost.
Well, thanks. I had already written up all of the adornments and put them into tables by faction, but they weren't it was just the Velius ones, and it wasn't the war runes. Death Dealer built on what I did, but put it into this awesome JavaScript calculator. I don't know if hopefully everyone has checked out his dormant calculator, because you go to it, you look at all, you have all your slots, and you say, okay, I'm grouping in Velius, or I raided in Sentinel's Fate, or I have these materials to make adornments. And you just go down the page and pick all your slots and what adornments you want, and then hit submit, and it makes you a shopping list.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I've used it, and I've redone a few times. So, and everybody can get to that from the EQ2Wire.com website. There's a link.
That's right. Top right corner, the armor guide and the adornments guide. And
I agree about the Velius armor one. That has got to be, I think, for a player, one of the most confusing things out there. And I think as we're getting into this new content is delivered by game update as opposed to at launch time, things are evolving as we're playing. So all of a sudden Drunder arrives, and you're like, okay, where does Drunder fit in all of this? I've been getting this gear. I've been raiding. I have some PQ. I have some heroic stuff. Do I have the best? Is there somewhere where I should be hunting? Because that those sort of guides aren't out there. So I have to say that's the one that caught my eye the most. And I have to say, even though I was outclassed some of the gear in there, I still read it all over because I'm like, oh, that's how they envisioned this all working and putting this all together. From a player's point of view, or at least from my point of view, it just seemed to be this hodgepodge mess of dungeons out there.
Well, definitely. You know, which dungeon you're running determines which pattern might drop. You know, and actually, that was another guide that I've been thinking of writing is, you know, you see them auctioned selling loot rights in the channel, which are the especially the chest piece, but also some of the other slots that drop as patterns. And it would be interesting to look at which dungeons they drop from, what the progression is. And then I'll have to rewrite the article, probably, the Velius armor guide. I'll have to update it for War of Zek.
Right. I actually kind of did that myself. I made my own shopping list for the easy mode raid zones that we started with. It took me a little while, and I don't know, maybe other people picked this up right away, that each mob in there drops one unique slot. So I just built my checklist of what mobs are in what zones and wrote next to them what piece would drop. So I started checking them off and saying, that way I would get excited about which mob we were going to next, because, ooh, this is something I still need, or, oh, it's a snoozer, I've already got the gloves. Back in the old days of EverQuest 2, it seemed you killed a mob and you didn't know what you're going to get. Now we're in this loot by checklist type of mode a little bit. I think it takes a little bit of the mystery and a little bit of the excitement away from it.
For so many of those slots, they've backed away from not just subclass, not just class, but just to archetype. So you basically kill that mob until you've gotten the item for your archetype. You know, you're a scout, you're a fighter. Oh, I got my scout item from this mob. I never need to kill that mob again. It's very strange.
Do you think that's taken a little bit away from the game? Because now we are maybe playing a little bit by checklist?
I think the itemization has definitely gotten... It's a straight line now. It's not a web. It's not a... you don't have the options that you had before.
Yeah, I agree with that. Can I ask you a real quick question? Because it's something Ellie and I have batted around in previous episodes time and time again. Smart loot. Like we were talking about earlier, you kill a particular mob and he drops a particular archetype. Certainly certain archetypes are not more popular but are more required in certain raid scenarios. So you have fighters with a small amount, but you might have many, many healers. But you continually get a 1 in 4 chance of a fighter item dropping that is redundant, overkill. Nobody needs it anymore. What's your whole take on smart loot in the game?
Well, there was a quote at Fanfare, I don't know if everyone caught it, which was that in previous expansions, fighter loot has internally been turned down on the frequency of drops. And that no longer happens. So now there is that 1 in 4 chance. And I don't think there should be a 1 in 4 chance for fighters, because in what raid situation are you going to have 6 fighters? You're not.
I agree.
I like percentages of smart loot, and I don't know if people caught that. I think it was during TSO that they would slowly turn up smart loot. Actually, before and after Fanfare, they turned up smart loot on different slots. So I think a certain degree of smart loot is helpful. I mean, because what happens is the random number generator in EQ2 has not favored everybody. And so you get into a situation where all of your mains and all of your alts have all their stuff, and then you have a healer that doesn't have anything.
Mm-hmm. Or no pants.
Or no pants. That's a bad situation.
That's Del's usual problem. He has no pants.
But my Toon has his pants now. It's just
now, yes.
The real Del.
Yes, finally.
Although I have to, can I share a really funny story? We were at Fanfare, and I was on my soapbox about smart loot, and I got a tweet from somebody who couldn't be at Fanfare and said the pants dropped. Healer pants dropped while I was at Fanfare. And I have to give the dev credit. They said, well, there you go, Del. That's smart loot in effect.
That's just harsh.
It was. I came back first raid after Fanfare, still no pants, but eventually I did get them. So that is my personal crusade, is some form of smart loot, obviously not brilliant loot or genius loot, but some form of weighted in the favor of the people who are there and present, not just the luck of the die roll.
But since it is by archetype, though, isn't it? Don't you have a better chance already of getting loot?
I think that's why they did the archetype loot, was to say, we don't have to do smart loot because it's now a 1 in 4 chance instead of a 1 in 12 chance. I think they probably did it for that purpose. And it was interesting to find out that even if they wanted to do smart loot in Velius, they can't, because none of the items are flagged in such a way that smart loot would work. So if they were going to do smart loot, they would have to introduce a new dungeon and have all of those items flagged in such a way that smart loot would work. So I really think they're banking on archetype is the answer.
But I do agree, it isn't equal. It's not an equal distribution of archetypes in the raid makeup. So it isn't really that smart. And you do have a disadvantage as a healer, or whatever whatever archetype is more abundant in a particular night.
And every once in a while you'll see someone say, well, they should make it so that there's 24 slots, there should be 24 classes required, there should be a reason for 6 fighters on a raid. I don't think you should try to force gameplay to fix a mechanic, or try to force I don't think you should force player behavior. I think you put together a group of 6 players, even if it's not the ideal group, you should be able to do most of the dungeons. And the raids, I don't know if this, I have not kept up with the difficulty and the mechanics of the raids in Velius. I'm guilty of not keeping up with that. But I know in Sentinel's Fate and TSO, it was not just you have to have a healer, but you have to have this healer class to kill this mob because of some unique ability.
In my experience in raiding right now, I don't think there's any of that. You must have a, pick one out of the 24. You must
Inquisitor,
have
a Fury, yeah.
To be successful, because they're the only one who can react to that. There are a few encounters where certain fighter types are required because, much like in, say, the old Shard of Hate, where mobs call out for a certain thing, or bad things will happen if you don't engage them with the right thing. Although I will say there are classes who are, but this is a since day one problem, who are more favorable in scenarios than others. Those with fast.
I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Of all the questions, the one that I heard and it really rung home to me was one of the fellows asked Zelgad about the desirability of Templars, and obviously that's a little near and dear to my heart in raiding. And Zelgad really had a good answer. He says, Templars have a role. They have a role in when you're starting out, they produce better survivability chances. They better mitigation, better hit points, all those sort of things that help you survive. Once you start moving into farming mode, the Inquisitor starts to become slightly more desirable because they are contributing to DPS and the ability to kill faster and more effectively. So each have their role. It's just as your raid force progresses, one becomes more desirable than the other. And it was the reverse in the beginning. And I said, wow, that's really a good answer. And I do think that is true. Now, granted, I don't like hearing that I'm going to be undesirable as my raid force gets better, but such is life.
I guess their solution to that is we're going to have new dungeons, new raids every 3 to 6 months.
You know, you're right. And that does kind of fit that paradigm a little bit, that if you're moving forward, you'll have to volley back and forth between that survivability mode and farmability, you know, desire to kill faster. Continuing on the whole raid topic a little bit more, you know, over the years we've heard the analogy of that it's 1% of 1% of the player base is involved in raiding. I think that's hard to say because it depends on what people define as raiding. Do you think the percentage of raiders is a small amount in the game?
I don't know if it is 1% of 1%. I mean, you know, we have a new producer, we have a new lead designer, we have a, you know, we have some new people on the EQ2 team. So a lot of that conventional wisdom's kind of gone out the window. I mean, Beast Lords are coming. Hello. So, you know, a lot of those things that we've heard, you know, I mean, years ago we heard that the EQ2 engine can handle level 200. Well, that was a quote out of Alpha. I mean, that's, you know, it's not even applicable anymore. So I don't know if that 1% of 1% is true. But I think the EQ2 team's tried to increase they've tried to open some doors for people to get into raiding. TSO, we saw Ward of Elements, which was the first time they had ever put in a times 2 raid that had loot good enough to run it, and that was designed that it would present some challenge, but you could progress through it. I mean, I was blown away by Ward of Elements, and I was really disappointed to see the follow-ups of Kern's Tower and the Vigilant. I think they both missed the mark compared to Ward of Elements. I know some people say Ward of Elements was a loot slot machine, but for those of us who were down in the trenches, we didn't have any raid gear. You know, we only had 180 AAs or however many it was at the time. It really it gave us a step up into times 4 raiding. And then now we've seen the easy mode raids, the hard mode raids. I mean, that's what Smokejumper said at Fanfare, was that by having that normal mode rating, you know, people like to play a game that they can actually win sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I really think it's great that they're putting in. So that I wish I had skipped TSO for rating and had started in Sentinel's Fate, because I think I would have gotten a lot more out of it, because you had this normal mode rating that you could get into.
Would you say, though, then the team is giving attention to all play styles? Do you feel it's well-balanced across the spectrum? Because EQ2 is a huge game with a lot of different ways to play it and a lot of different things to do it. Do you think everybody is getting their fair shake?
I think so. I mean, definitely crafting gets a lot of attention. I mean, we just saw multi-housing. We keep seeing more houses go in. Of course, some of them are station cash, but you know, we see a lot going into crafting. Grouping. I mean, we're getting new dungeons every 3 months now. And then raiding. You know, it's interesting because in Kunark, we had Vishan's Peak, and I was blown away the first time I went into that zone. I was like, look, this giant zone was developed just for raiders. Have we really had that before and after? I think since then and before then, they've repurposed other zones, or they would design a group zone and then use it as a raid, or design a raid zone, but then take parts of it and use it as a group zone. I think Vishan's Peak is the only time that a zone was designed just for raiding.
That's a really good point. I never even thought about it that way. And it's enormous.
Oh, definitely. So I don't think that they're focusing too much attention on any one style of gameplay. I am a champion of duo and trio gameplay, because, you know, there are a lot of husband and wife. There's a lot of, you know, I want to play with my girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. I think that the EQ2 team has been hesitant about adding duo and trio content, because as soon as you take a player and slap raid gear on them, they can solo it. Mm-hmm. Or you can bring a group of six in and you have, you know, you're giving loot away for free. I really like the Knights of the Dead. What was it? The Haunted Manor Mansion. It had a maximum of 3 players, and most people did it with 1 or 2 players. I really like that. I really wish that they would repeat that.
But do you think they give a lot of credit to the duo players in the quest lines, which are, you know, some people label them as solo? You know, and certainly they are soloable, but you could duo them and trio them together. That way they might not present as much challenge, but really after a while, do solo quests really present that much of a challenge anyways?
They don't present a lot of challenge. You know, Kunark was notorious for the long, unbroken chains of quests. And if you got together with someone that was even slightly ahead of you or slightly behind you, it was just frustrating. And also, a lot of those quests would not give group updates. You would kill a mob, and something would drop, and it was just, it was an item, so only one person would get an update. Now, they've really, in Velius, have worked hard to make it so that as many quests as possible give a group update.
I agree. The Kunark days of group questing was brutal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's being kind to it. I can think on several occasions of where are you in this quest line while I'm on, you know, the middle of the, I'm 3/4 of the way through. Let's not group. It's not worth it. I don't want to go back and kill solo mobs over again just to catch you up to me, and then we'll be out of time. That was very difficult. That was a very tough time. It was an interesting way to approach leveling and giving out XP, but I think it came back to bite them a little bit because of that, the way you described it there, that unbroken chain.
It was 400 quests or something like that, and I've joked since then. I swear, when we logged in on day one of Kunark, I swear I saw a message pop on my screen. For your convenience, group XP in dungeons has been disabled. Because it sure felt like that. You know, I'll tell you a secret, but you can't tell anybody. When Kunark came out, I hit the quests. I tried to make it happen. And after a while, I leveled my sage from 20 to 80 before I got back into the solo questing. So the solo grind of trade skilling was less mind-numbing than those quests. I really prefer grouping. I think that getting together with people, talking, you know, going and tackling that content, I think it's my preferred gameplay. I mean, I understand people like to solo quest. You never want to force one or the other. You never want to force grouping. You have to group to level. You have to solo quest to level. I don't think either of those is the right option.
Yeah, that quest series really burned a lot of people out on questing altogether. I mean, there's even guilds named something like Never Quest Again. I think there's one.
There is one on Unrest, yeah.
So it makes me sad because people have this sour taste in their mouth about questing, because I love doing quests. I just don't love doing 400 quests in a row.
Well, and not to harp on this too much, but the other problem with the Kunark quests was we didn't feel like we were part of the world, mm-hmm. and we didn't feel like any of the quests that we were doing had any ramifications. And especially when you had these faction lines that you were doing, that you were working against each other. You were a triple agent. To me, it was just there was no impact on what you were doing. And that's why I've been such a proponent of the Othmir and Thurgodon quests in Velius. They're well written. I actually read the quest text because it's interesting. What you're doing actually changes the zone. The NPCs actually change. The zone actually changes. Also, it's not, I have a quest for you, but you have to travel 1,000 kilometers to go to the update and then send you there 4 or 5 times. You know, there isn't any of that. So the Othmir quests, I've done them now on 3 characters and I didn't get bored of them. The Thurgodon are they're pretty good as well. The Rygor quests are pretty good. I'm not really sure why I'm helping orcs. But they have the best armor, so you know, I'll put that to the side.
Yeah, everything I hated about Sentinel's Fate questing, I love about DOV questing.
It's interesting, you know, and then you pick up the Othmir quests when you get to the other side, when you get into the Eastern Wastes.
Yeah.
You know, and you finish the storyline, and things actually change. That's interesting.
And that there's trade skill quests as well that bring you to do kind of the same thing.
Oh, definitely.
Flying Mount and all of that.
I got to be honest, I'm not super thrilled about the DOV factioning system because there's a few places where it doesn't make sense to me. So the Rygor in the fort love me, but the ones right outside the gate want to kill me on sight. I don't get that. Why am I working for orcs when I've been mass slaughtering them outside their gates? Do they not look out the window and see me out there killing them?
They didn't get the memo.
Maybe not.
They did tell you there are some outside the Citadel walls that won't recognize that you're a friend. I mean, it's a little flimsy.
I thought that was a little weird, and especially when you're early on in the faction questing, you actually have to go into camps and click on things and do things and cure them of poison or whatever, all while they're beating on you.
Yeah.
So I would like run into the camp, click on the items, and then run off a cliff and fly away just so I wouldn't have to kill any of them. But it was very odd.
And
I'm hoping that there will be a quest somewhere along the way that finally you mend all those fences and they leave you alone.
And the same thing with the Rhyme versus the Cauldane. Take a drink. But I can understand each of them are opposing each other and I want to work for each other, but I guess I want to be the hero. And I guess there is the point with that you can say, Del, you don't have to do those quests if you don't want to. I want to be the hero. I want to be the good guy. But I'm working for the bad guys here a little bit. And then meanwhile, I'm going.
Wait, who are the bad guys again?
The Rhyme.
I've remained blissfully aware of their motives and their purpose on Norath. And maybe that's a sad thing that I should be exploring that. I've always seen them as a thorn in the side of all the important things that are happening.
To me, it just doesn't make sense, you know, this whole... To me, faction should mean something. I shouldn't be able to be loved by enemies. I should either work for one or work for the other. I don't like the double agent business, but that's just me. Although, oddly enough, and this is how disturbed I am in-game, I flew back to Jarthas Waste the other night because I was short 50 Rhyme faction, and I went and killed a bunch of sharks and got them some shark meat to get myself back up to max faction with them.
That's way, way more obsessive compulsive than I.
I got to get all those faction lines all the way to the right. It's a disease. I understand.
So it's all right. I have harvesting. That's my.
So do they have a clinic for that or a medication?
Yeah. More accounts, I guess.
I get faction until the vendors will talk to me, and then I move on.
It's part of my completionist behavior. I have to have everything maxed out and max faction. I'll admit I'm still running the daily Authmer quests because those count towards mission achievement count, and I'm closing in on secret agent. So even though I'm max faction, I'm still running those five or six, maybe the seven of them total, between the Authmer and the Gnolls every day over and over again. Ironically, the Thurgadin trade skillers don't count towards mission, so I stopped doing those guys.
So you keep up on your achievements.
Yes, I will admit I am an achievement junkie. Do you play those at all or have interest in them?
I use them to look at the locations to make sure I've discovered everywhere in a zone. But I have not. I haven't gone out of my way to complete an achievement. Besides Lore and Legend. Lore and Legend, I'll get them all.
I have gone way out of my way to get an achievement. I've sat there clicking on a bell for 20 minutes to get an achievement.
You know, I guess the two of you look at Zalmat's website, his achievements website.
Yes.
Yes, and he's just bringing that back online now.
Yeah, he put it on a new domain, eq2achieve.com. Thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those achievements, you don't know what it is until you've already got it. So you have to ask other people. And so this is another one of those guides. I think it's great.
Yeah, and the little secret achievements are revealed.
You're just doing your normal gameplay, and you get an achievement. Like, what did I get that for?
I really do like the achievement system because I think it brings in a lot of replayability to the game. And, you know, you were talking about doing the Authmer quests over and over again. For some folks, you know, doing those quests again isn't fun, but mass slaughtering 10,000 fairies is so that they can be destroyer of fairies. I think that's a good thing. I think EQ2 needs those sort of things to help promote that longevity and keep people coming back and logging in and playing regularly. I think achievements were a really good thing. Now, a lot of people fluff them off as just, well...
Oh, this is a copy of it. They copied this from Xbox. They copied this from something else. But, you know, they've made it their own.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing for the game. It's not something you have to do, but for those who enjoy that, it is something to do.
What do you think about at Fanfare? They talked about the expansion sort of moving away from being content-based and moving more towards features. adding more features to the game. What do you think about that change going forward? Do you think it's a good thing for the game? And do you think this is going to be sort of long-term?
Well, one thing it's done is it's led to player confusion. Not everybody reads the forums. And they're getting bits and pieces of info from their friends, and they're hearing, oh, so there's no more Velius, or, you know, they're hearing different things. So I think they're going to have to educate people for one thing. I think it's a daring idea to say, okay, we're going to give you new zones, new dungeons, new raids for free for the next, 18 months? I heard through the middle of 2013, Velius dungeons, they're going to be adding new ones and new zones. They haven't really been selling it as optional. And I think that raiders and high-level groups are going to feel that it's a requirement to get it just for the AA increase. Everyone else, they get to evaluate the features. They get to ask their friends if they want to buy it or not. I mean, I don't even think the pricing's been decided yet. You know, everyone's assuming it's going to be $40, but they could set a different price. I do think one of the kind of side effects of doing that is that on launch day of the expansion, the servers aren't going to be crashing left and right as thousands of people try to log in and level up or get into the new zones. You know, that's actually made launch day kind of an unpleasant experience for people. You know, I know some people who they're like, oh, I'm not going to log in for a few days until all of that shakes out.
At Fanfare, a developer had said, and I think I actually read it on Wire, that they wouldn't be increasing the level cap for, it sounded like, a lot of years.
I heard that from an EQ2 developer, that even just going to 90, they had some mechanic problems that they had to work around. And going to level 100, for whatever reason, would require some major mechanics changes so that the mobs wouldn't break or so that all the mechanics would work. So I heard that it would actually be a lot of work to get to level 100.
Yeah, I had heard the same thing. And they didn't say, I don't believe, specifically what their problem was. So I guess my takeaway was that maybe they've created their own Y2K problem where they're stuck with things in maybe two-digit format only or something.
I'm not sure why. You know, and that's an interesting question. You know, is raising the level cap progression? And I've kind of felt that it wasn't progression because, okay, you have to find some way to level as fast as you can, or some people feel that way. Not everybody feels that way, but some people do. And so, okay, we log in on launch day. Oh, let's find all the exploits to level.
Mm-hmm. Grind.
You know? Or we have to do these long quest lines. And so you kind of resent, we talked about Kunark, but, you know, you can almost resent the quest lines. Because with Velius, you didn't have to do them. You could level in Sentinel's Fate. So it was kind of like, you know, this is optional. You did it for the gear more than the levels, a lot of people. And actually, you know, I just got my Conjurer up to 86. I didn't go to 90. I went to 86, just leveling up in dungeons because I'm going to do the Othmir stuff. So if they raise the level cap to 100, then I've heard from developers that takes, you know, 3 to 6 months of their time just putting in the quests, putting in the new spells, upgrades of all of your spells, which doesn't really give players any growth, but yet it takes a ton of developer time.
Yeah, I have to say, I've always been of the camp that said, in order to sell boxes, you need to have a level increase. People are going to want to buy your expansion because there's X amount of new levels to get. And that was part of the progression. To move forward, you had to go up in levels. And I always believed that and really subscribed to that theory. But I was listening, I think, to Feral.
He does a View from the Top or Epic Slant.
Yeah, blog. Yeah. Podcast. He was talking about the challenge, though, if somebody goes into the store and sees a box on the shelf that says now with level 100, why would they want to buy that? Because their first thought is, oh my God, I got to go from 0 to 100. That's too much, too far. I don't want to buy that if I have to work at that to get to where everybody else has already been playing. So this concept of MMO levels being a requirement for expansion, I'm kind of his mind thought now, levels may not be a good thing, especially when you start getting up into very high numbers of them to reach end game.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of conversations in the last few days on the forums about low-level grouping. People have really stood on each side of the line. I should say lines have been drawn. Because some people really do like to group at low level, but or play at low level, but a lot of those people don't group. And then the people who play at high level, a lot of them do group. So if you want to group with your friends, if you want to group with your guildmates, and you've just started playing EQ, yeah, it's a long road ahead.
Well, I do think when Age of Dentistry launches in November that it's going to be full of low-level players. I think this Beast Lord is going to drop population Velio zones through the floor, and everybody's going to be back in the newbie zones leveling their Beast Lords day one.
Well, you ain't kidding. I think you're going to have thousands of Beast Lords leveling up, and that's going to be to the exclusion of everything else. And so then once they get to level 90, then we find out, okay, are they overpowered, underpowered? How many patches is it going to take to fix them? I'm maybe a little cynical there, but...
I just wonder how they're going to do this going forward with these expansions being more about features, with, I guess, the next expansion, Beast Lords being probably the biggest thing. How are they going to top that? I mean, what can top Beast Lords?
I do think we have a lot of things coming. I think Beast Lords is going to be the biggest impact. Hopefully summoners are not counting on a pink slip 3 months from now. I think Design Your Own Dungeon could be bigger than a lot of people are. I think a lot of people are doubting its future, but I think it could be big.
I don't know. I'm not banking my hopes and futures on DYOD. I think it's going to be cool. But I think, much like Arenas, I disagree with the opinion that it's not going to be Arenas 2.0. I think it is. I don't want to think that, but if I had to hedge a bet, I would. I think people are going to do it for a little bit, much like Sid and Chairs. They're going to do it once or twice and say, wow, that looked really cool. But then they're going to go back to what they were doing before, especially if you have to play it in avatar form and not your toon form.
Well, the devil is going to be in the details on that, because if Design Your Own Dungeon is really open-ended, if we can pick and choose from a lot of different dungeons, if we can choose from a lot of different mobs, special effects, I mean, we've heard we're going to be able to quest for or pick up like different alarms or different things that we can place that make the mobs behave differently, and if the rewards are right, because it's all about the rewards, unfortunately. That's what we saw with Battlegrounds. Everyone ran the Battlegrounds when the rewards were viable for PvE. As soon as they split the stats where the Battleground gear would get you killed in Velius, Battlegrounds went away. As far as the Design Your Own Dungeon and you're not able to play your own character, you have to play an avatar, that's going to come down to, are the avatars going to have like maybe 4 or 5 abilities and that's it? Or are they going to be a filled-out class? I mean, if the avatar is designed with little tricks and different things and almost like it feels like, wow, I wish I could play this class in the real game. If they put that much depth into these avatars that you can play, then I think it's going to be a success. If it's like the what's that quest in Loping Plains where you have to put on a mask?
Yes, I found that mask in my bag the other day, the veil mask or something, yes.
Yeah, you do a quest and you only have like 3 combat arts and a heal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not a class.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing exciting about that. You know, I don't know. I mean, Smokejumper said that we want to try different styles of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
And if they make it interesting, then who knows? You know, people have compared Design Your Own Dungeon and EQ2 to other games. And I think there's 2 things that EQ2 has that other MMOs don't have, which might make it more successful. And the first is EQ2 has the most developed housing system. And a lot of people play EQ2 just because of the housing system. All those people are going to want to try out Design Your Own Dungeon. And the second thing is that I think, for whatever reason, EQ2 players have maybe a little more patience than WoW or Rift or some of the other games. And I think that patience to want to create content could be a success. We'll see when it comes out.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I think what might keep DYOD in perspective is limiting its hype. You know, when something gets overhyped, we build expectations that this will be the best thing since sliced bread.
Definitely.
And when it isn't sliced bread, oh, this stinks. So if they keep their expectations for us low, they will certainly exceed them. But I do think it's going to come down to the rewards. People are going to run these for the rewards, like you say, for Battlegrounds as well. Once they've exhausted those rewards, I think it's going to become shelfware. I'd like to be proven wrong, but that's the way I'm looking now, and maybe I have a jaded view of that sort of thing.
No, I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, people have presented a lot of reasons why it could be abandoned after a month. You know, they're putting two NPCs. We know what one of them is going to be, and that's going to be items for your own DYODs. So you can actually spend tokens to buy materials to make your own. Then the other NPC is going to be gear for your main character, whatever character I guess you chose to run the DYOD, but you don't play that character. We don't know. You know, how is that going to fit into progression? People have said a lot about public quest gear. Some people say it was so overpowered that everybody felt that they had to run it. Well, I'm glad public quests were in, because when Velius launched, there were a lot of problems, a lot of bugs with the dungeons. So at least people had something to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, MMO design, you have to add things for people to do.
So you talked about what you thought would have the biggest impact from the expansion. What's one of the features you think has the biggest potential for being a disappointment for players?
You know, it's funny, because when Mercenaries first came up, the first question that people had was, oh, can I use it in a level 90 group? Are they going to be a suitable replacement in level 90 raid zones? I thought that was a puzzling question. But my perspective on Mercenaries is only what I've heard from EQ2, which, if you remember when they were introduced, that was actually kind of presented in kind of a silly way, which was they showed character dying over and over, trying to level up in EQ1, and you couldn't because it's not a solo-friendly game. So in Mercenaries in EQ1, it's used as a partner for leveling, and then once you get to level 85 or 80 or whatever, you're done with them. So I don't know how popular Mercenaries are going to be at level 90 or how they're going to balance them. I mean, if they're so good that they can replace a group member, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're not powerful at all, you're not going to use them at level 90, even just for solo stuff.
I am definitely worried about Mercenaries, because I am definitely worried about losing my raid slot to a Mercenary. Because if the Mercenary can follow Joust commands, he's already got one step ahead of me.
Yeah, that's, you know, they keep talking about brains, that Mercenaries are going to have better brains. Are they going to joust?
And
if they tell better jokes, we're all in trouble.
Or worse, they cyber better than me.
Boy.
But I think what might be interesting is if they can enhance play. I think that's the key, is enhancing play as opposed to reproducing play. If they can enhance play so I can go back and farm Runny Eye 2 for shinies or something like that, or do some content that's a little bit beyond me, I think they're a good thing. If they become a complete replacement for another person, I'm going to say I think that spells the doom of the game, because it will become a console game. It'll become an MMO other than massively mercenary-oriented game, maybe.
You know, if we had a developer on, one of the questions I would ask the developer is, do players trying to do more with their character than the game was designed for, does that scare the hell out of you? Does that keep you up at night? Because I love that kind of stuff. You know, I'm solo. I go into a place where a solo player has no business being, and I see how much I can do. And you see threads about this, like, oh, I did this. I ran this dungeon, or I got to this place that you're not supposed to be able to get to without a group or without a raid. I think that stuff's great.
Mm-hmm.
But it must keep the developers up at night.
You know, I bet it does, although it depends on what we're getting out of it. In my case, if I'm Delmon and I shouldn't be able to run Runny Eye 2, you know, just as an example, by myself, there's certainly no loot in there today that Delmon would equip want, at best I would sell it to a vendor or mute it. But if I'm getting shinies don't affect progression. They don't make me a better player. They just make me feel more complete at the end of the night if I get one that I need. So is that really harming anything? I don't think so. So I don't think that would keep them up at night. Now, if I'm going in and I'm beating Kratok by myself and getting loot that I can sell or affect gameplay, then yeah, I think that would keep them up.
Well, it's interesting because I have a level 90 monk, which I've recently brought up. And it occurred to me, hey, I could go to Runny Eye 2 and get the shinies. And it's that difficult as a monk. But then you say, okay, well, are we going to try to nerf Feign Death? Are we going to try to put some restriction? And we actually saw that restriction on all of the key mobs in TSO, Sentinel's Fate, and I guess Velius as well. All of the key mobs have this effect on them called Mandate, where if you're a monk or whatever other character, as soon as you try to kill that key mob, it forces your target away, and you can't kill it or cure it or do anything. You have to have a healer present. Of course, some people have been able to work around it with different stats and different cures, but apparently developers see getting those, getting that plat or getting those shards solo as crossing the line.
I was on the same exact kick. I decided to level a Bruiser just so I could do that with him so that he could farm shinies for me. Right. Until Velius came along. Now all of a sudden, Delmon can fight his way through a lot of zones that prior to this expansion he couldn't have done. I can solo the bulk of Runny Eye 2. I can solo a fair amount of library by myself. And as a Templar, I find that shocking that yeah. I'm able to do that. And I have easy mode gear that's adorned from Velius. It was the mechanics change from having many stats to just being two. Now everything for me is wisdom and stamina, and I have a lot of that.
Right.
Velius
pretty much tripled everyone's power, even from 2 years ago.
Right.
So it's interesting to go back to those level 80 zones and see the effect.
Allie and I have been doing that recently. We started out with, no, we can't do that. And I'm like, well, let's give it a shot. I'm thinking I'm pretty kick-ass now. I'm pretty powerful with these huge wisdom and stamina numbers. And sure enough, we're able to beat content that was certainly beyond our abilities prior to Velius.
Yeah, we do owe a lot. And actually, you mentioned the mandate. It, I'm constantly having to make sure that Dell is actually paying attention because I'm usually the one tanking.
Ah.
So I get this arcane.
Are you gonna cure this sometime today?
Exactly.
Maybe. Maybe not. Am I watching Glee or am I watching Allie die on the screen? Not sure. Sometimes it's 50-50. Although I think they have somewhat beaten a little bit of the whole flop farming shiny mechanism with shinies not popping until you kill the first named.
Mm-hmm.
Before they used to populate with when the zone populated, so you can run around flopping and getting them. Now you have to actually kill at least something. I think we had to see that in, Shard of Love, maybe. And certainly it's been carried forward. I know it was in Kern's Tower because we can be standing right on them and they appear at our feet after we kill that first named.
The developers are always trying to build a better mousetrap.
And, of all things, too, shinies.
Hey, those are anywhere 8, 10, 20 plat.
Absolutely, some of them can be. And who would have thought when EverQuest 2 launched that shinies would take on a subculture of their own?
I wonder if they actually had that intent or had a clue that it would be as addictive and obsessive.
I don't think they did. I think it was just something they threw in as a it'll keep them busy type of thing. And look at where it's become. It's a whole industry now.
Right. A mini game.
Heck, we even have mobs now that have the name of a question mark.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. Kill the shiny.
Or trapped ones. We had trapped ones in Unrest, didn't we, too?
Yeah. You get the shiny and it doesn't turn out so well.
Yeah, especially after everyone splits up for the evening, you try and grab those shinies and not share them. And it turns out it's three mobs that kill you.
So, Allie, are you saying that after we're done for the night, you go back in with your blue shiny goggles on and pick them all up?
I was actually talking about Unrest.
Oh, okay.
I have done that before.
You know, that blue shinies thing has been a big point of contention. Because, you know, you're wearing the blue goggles. No one else in the group has spent the plat or harvest of the items to be able to see them. Mm-hmm. Should they be on the round robin, the loot? And so I think now some people just wait until the group has left and then go and get the blue shinies.
Yeah.
That's deplorable. I would never do that and admit to it. Although that is an interesting question. I think we've talked about it in the past. My opinion is no, I don't think they should be. I think only the people who have the item should be able to roll on them. That's my opinion.
Now, Velius doesn't have one, right?
Correct.
Because we had Faedwer, right? We had Kunark, TSO, and SF all had their own goggles or eyepiece or cap, right? It was a hat.
Yeah, there was a hat. Runny Eye was a hat, I think.
And then Runny Eye had the hat. Of course, it's funny. I started running Runny Eye 2 with my monk to get those shinies. And I was going to get all the ones to get the hat so that I could get the blue shiny so I could get that item that gives you the power back, the Mark of Anaxfin. But then I looked at the cost of the shinies that I could sell them for, and I'm like, forget it. I can make more money off of... Of course, I think there's a red adornment that also has that power regen on it. That's handy on a power draining mob.
I have to be honest, I'm not a big fan of these things we have to wear to see other things. One, because they just clog up bag space. I don't know why they don't make them knowledge book items, buffs of some type that we can turn on, and so we don't have to have items. I don't know what the internal costs in terms of database and computing power of a knowledge book item versus an item in game, but I'd certainly like to get rid of a lot of these keys and things we wear to see other things.
I think that's on their long. Well, that's what Spokejumper said, is that's on their long term plan. Is he doesn't want quests to put items in your bags. Period. He thinks it's nuts. So, and I'm in agreement with him. You know, the key. I think we need a key ring or something, because, you know, I have a whole bank slot of just items to unlock Kunark and different zones.
Mm-hmm.
All these little crystals and stuff that I have to have to clickies. Do all those old zones, clickies. And at least with the, you were talking about shinies, at least the red shinies, you don't have to, you don't even have to have it in your inventory, I don't think. I think it works from your bank.
The earring, yeah, you don't have to wear it.
The earring of the solstice, yeah.
You don't have to wear it. You don't have to have it in your possession. You're flagged.
It would be nice if they went back to those items and retrofitted those with that flagging capability for the blues. It's just one less thing I have to worry about or be rummaging through my bag while my group is traipsing off through the dungeon and I'm falling behind while I'm looking for that item or something.
And did you mention Game Update 61 at all, which is on test?
We have not. Let's talk a little bit about 61.
Well, it's definitely gotten tempers flared. And a lot of reaction from, a lot of passionate reaction from players. And I think part of the problem is that we had fanfare. We had all of this slides and information and people got excited about it. And then we get home and we it almost feels like bait and switch with the AA restrictions. You know, at level 10, you can only spend 50 AAs, period. At level 30, you can only spend 100 AAs, period, and only in certain trees. Now, they've since changed this in the update notes, but you have all this communication at fanfare, and there's been so little communication since fanfare. I almost think that marketing has Smokejumper, you know, strapped to a chair and not allowed to post, because he's posted so little. Yeah, so the first one was the AAs, and they softened the blow on that by, you know, at level 10, yes, you can spend points in both class and subclass. And then at 50, it unlocks the Shadows tree. That's the biggest change. The other change that people have been concerned about actually is the need before greed. They've changed it now so that if a group is set to need before greed, you cannot click need on anything that your character cannot equip. And when I heard about this at fanfare, I thought that was actually a great idea. Because in pickup groups, you have this problem where someone will click need. And the group's like, what did you do that for? And they say, oh, well, I need it for my alt. You know, they didn't tell anybody that they're rolling need for their alt. I mean, I would not necessarily group with another. I would look at the group makeup and say, well, okay, we have three scouts in this group, or we have, you know, I'm a scout and we have two mages. If I found out that they're both rolling need for scout alts, well, I might want to switch groups because that means I'm competing with them for items. So I think in pickup groups it's going to be a great thing. But I can certainly see the player concern about how much of an extra hassle it's going to be for guild groups where you already know everybody, where mm-hmm. they're not going to click need unless they have a good reason for doing so. So the change the way they have it for pickup groups, I think, is great. I think for groups where you already know everybody, it's going to be a hassle. And I also think it's going to be a problem in raids. So hopefully they'll add an option. You know, Game Update 61 is on test a full month before it launches. So maybe there's enough time where they will listen to feedback and change some of these things.
Yeah, when I first heard about the whole need before greed change, I'm like, well, I don't know if I really like that, because of the exact scenario you talk about, where we're in a friends and family group or a guild group, and you say, hey, can I roll need on that for a so-and-so alt? Vast majority of the time, everybody goes, yeah, sure. Who cares? Go right ahead. Take it if you want. So they'll just need, and everybody else will greed on it because they were either going to vendorize or mute it or whatever to it. But when it comes to what I think this will eventually apply to, which is some form of cross-server group finder, and I wondered if that's what this was all predicated on, that somewhere down the road, the group finder will be cross-group, so you won't want people just needing on everything and having no skin in the game, because they're going to go back to their home server, and you can bitch about them all you want, but they're already back home on their home server, and there's nothing you can do to affect them.
It could very well be. I mean, I did not get the impression that cross-server grouping was right around the corner. I think there's just huge development problems with that, because just being able to trade with someone, when you look at Battlegrounds, and the reason they were able to get Battlegrounds off the ground is how much functionality they disabled first.
That may be me wishfully thinking that it's right around the corner, but I thought that this was one of the first steps in changing player behavior to get towards it.
I mean, I think the Dungeon Finder is going to be awesome. You know, Smokechopper made a point that it's not just level 90. It's going to be any dungeon. And there will be, what was it, a 25% chance increase on loot if you are willing to accept any group instead of being picky.
Really? I didn't hear that. Wow.
Yeah, there's going to be a 25% chance increase if you're willing to just take whatever group it offers you.
It's very interesting. I hadn't heard that either.
I'm very excited for the dungeon finding capabilities, because, as I've said in the past, I'm willing to group with Satan himself for a quest update. And sometimes it's really hard to get a group now at this point to go back into Umbral Halls for, you know, one kill for a quest update for a mirror so that I can get my access done. So I'm sitting around waiting for Umbral Halls to come up as the hot zone or the Daily Double or something like that so I can get a better chance at it. But it's hit or miss trying to get some groups. And I guess counter argument to that could be, well, G-Del, you could be the one to be the group leader and put it all together. But for the same other people don't do it, I don't want to be the leader, because I think there's this unwritten rule: when you are the leader, you are the knower of all information and the great coordinator. And I don't want to be that.
That's a huge problem with putting together groups, that the person that puts it together, there's this responsibility, there's this expectation. And a lot of people don't want to mess with it.
Absolutely. So that's where I'm coming from, why I don't want to be the leader to do that, because I'm not always the expert, or I'm not up to speed on everything. And I have to say, I've been lagging a lot in my heroic dungeon running because of that, and because there don't seem to be a lot of groups running some of these dungeons all that much for quest updates.
Well, and people are running the easy dungeons, you know, Pools and Ascent, Ishard Keep. You know, they're running those just to get the shards, and in the case of Ishard Keep, to get the crystals,
right,
or the gems.
And you were saying earlier too, and I do this in a dungeon, and I hate to be the one dragging the group down, going, I want to read this quest text. or I want to make sure I'm getting all my updates right while I'm in here. If there's something extra I got to click on, I want to make sure I've read my quest notes. Some groups are not interested in that. They're turn and burn. You know, we're going to get through this in 30 minutes or less and get out of here. Well, they're not patient enough to deal with a quester, who I like to be, reading quest text or reading NPC text while they're going through.
That's why we have Monday nights.
What's on Monday night?
Del and I have a quest group. We do old school quests usually.
Cool. One thing you can do, I don't know if it helps, one thing you can do is you can have all of your NPCs say in a separate tab on your chat.
Yes, but I like to, especially when they interact and they start talking back and forth, I want to read what I'm saying back to them as well. So it's that whole interaction. And that's why I'm also on this kick of we need a confirmation box when we get pulled into a zone. I absolutely love the ability to be sucked into a zone, except for when I'm at a merchant or I'm going to a quest NPC to get an update and I get pulled into the zone without my express written permission.
I agree with that. You know, the first time that I ran pools, I was flying to the place where the quests are. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even get there, and I got sucked into the zone. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, you guys pulled me in. Okay, share all the quests. Well, no one shared the Immortal Pest with me, which is that access quest. So I ran pools the first time. I didn't get unlocked or access or anything. It's like, gee, guys, let me get the quests or you know, take just a moment. I mean, everyone is in such a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. So I think that's one of those other things that kind of makes me not want to group at times or pug group at times because I don't have that freedom to say, hey, I want to go get the quest or I want to read this text or don't pull me in. Because so many groups are just, as soon as we get six and we've got the classes we need, we're rolling.
As fast as we can and race to the top of the parse.
Exactly. And they want to be done with you as quickly as possible as well.
Burn, burn, burn.
Turn and burn.
So, Felden, before we move on, the most important question of the day, bacon or ham?
Definitely bacon.
Excellent. Excellent choice. You can come be a guest on our show any day.
Did you write that question before or after you knew I was in Copenhagen?
We actually asked that of all of our guests.
Because, you know, Copenhagen and Denmark is a huge exporter of bacon.
Was not aware of that.
But most of the bacon you get in Europe is from Denmark.
So do you have, like, different flavors of bacon? Different varieties?
I wouldn't say that. Different thicknesses. That's the same as the U.S. It's funny because you're not going to find applewood bacon. You're not going to find different things. Denmark also has the best butter in the world.
Really?
I see a theme here.
I can't believe it's not butter. I got to put a stop to this because we're going to end up talking about greasy fat foods.
I'm already hungry.
I know, for another 30 minutes and then we're all going to end up hungry. So let's turn our attention to our least favorite, most favorite things.
Sounds good.
All right, Allie, do you want to lead us off with your least favorite thing this week?
Pretty easy. It's actually a repeat. My least favorite thing this week, it's still bothering me. My guild events log is still borked since the Unrest server merge. Events are all out of order, and every time the server resets, a bunch of deleted quests come back, or deleted events come back from the time frame around when the merge happened, like in December.
Felden, do you have a least favorite item for this week?
Well, we were talking about Game Update 61 earlier. I would say my least favorite item, you know, I know a lot of work is going into it, but I think in the long term, the itemization changes that are coming. I hate to say this, but having one option for gear for every archetype from level 20 to level 90, it takes away a lot of choice. It takes away a lot of player choice. And I'm not sure it's the right direction.
My least favorite thing this is the Kelithin Aether racing. I cannot seem to figure out which way is up, down, left, or right. I wish those rings, the next one, would light up the minute I go through the current one. It seems you got to go through and go for a few more meters, and then the next one lights up. I need every help I can get on these damn things. So please light those rings up sooner. All right, Allie, your most favorite thing this week.
My most favorite thing, at the risk of sounding completely hokey, is having Felden as a guest. We are very lucky to have you in the EQ2 community. Your analytical and enlightening posts and comments inspire thought and discussion among players, and I think that really enriches the EQ2 experience.
I would say my most favorite thing this week is seeing fan sites maybe getting a little more attention, and I think that started with seeing John Smedley on Jethro Silverwing show. I don't think we would have seen that a year ago. So maybe there's some more attention going to be paid to the EQ2 fan sites and not just the press sites.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to Smedley on Jethel's show. It was really interesting to hear from him. And he didn't come across as a CEO. He came across as a gamer, as a guy, and I enjoyed listening to him for that. My most favorite thing this week is the Blessed Kul'Dane prayer shawl and the fact that I finally have mine. After much foot dragging and hemming and hawing, I finally did it. It cost me, and I didn't know this, you can, when you die in crafting gear, you have to repair it. I didn't know this. It actually takes damage like real armor. Because I went through quite a bit of it, not clicking the right reactives while trying to get to the through the final steps there. So I can say that Delmon has his in EQ2, and even Mondel back in EverQuest 1 had his as well. So I've managed to do it twice. I don't think I'm going to do it on any alts. That was a lot of work, but I'm very happy to have it finally. And I thought it was a really great quest. I did enjoy it. And it pays homage to something that I do remember very fondly from EverQuest 1.
Well, congrats. I didn't know you could die from trade skilling anymore.
You can on that quest.
I haven't died since the Forge, Days of the Forge.
That prayer shawl quest is something else. It's really, in a way, it has the difficulty of grouping up. It has that difficulty of adventuring. It brought that to trade skilling.
Yeah, and you were saying something earlier, Felden, and I think it's very true, especially like the Ring War. We have this public quest, this Ring War public quest, and as a mechanics, okay, we all know how it works. We've all done it. But there are so many quests in DOV that weave in and out of the Ring War mechanic event, and the prayer shawl is one of them. It explains why it's still going on, and there are other quests that you do in Thurgadin as well that talk about the Ring War and why it's still happening and what you can do to help and how certain people are ashamed of it and that sort of stuff. I really thought I was affecting the world of Norrath through this quest and the other ones that surround the Ring War mechanic. It's just not this one thing that got plunked in game. And I really, really enjoyed that. And I got to meet Brell again, so that was huge. That was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the quest writing has gone way up in quality in the last couple of years. And the artwork in Velius is out of this world.
So I won't spoil it for you, Allie, because I know you haven't finished it yet, but yes, you can die, and you'll die many ways frustratingly.
Looking forward to it.
Yes, you'll have to finish it up and let us know.
All right.
So this week we are scheduled to have an Allie angle, but we have decided to modify the Allie angle a little bit this week and twist it into the Felden angle. So it's an even bigger, greater, more awesome sauce segment of the show.
I know I'm in trouble already.
So, Felden, are you ready? Because Allie is never ready for the Allie angle, but are you ready for the Felden angle?
I'm definitely not ready.
Okay, here we go then. So strap yourself in. So, Felden, the question this week for the Felden angle is, what are the three most pressing issues in EverQuest 2 in your opinion?
Yeah, I'm stuck already. Okay, I'll start at the bottom. Number three, Rangers. We are competing with Coercers, Summoners, Assassins, and other classes for DPS, but we bring nothing else to the table. We need a hate transfer, a group buff, something to bring us up, because right now, Coercers and Summoners, they bring huge things to the group. Also, Rangers are spending several platinum per week on ammunition. I don't know any other class that has to pay consumables to do their DPS. That's number three.
I love that one.
For some reason, I knew, Allie, you would be on board with that one.
I'm all on board. I've been talking about Rangers having to buy their DPS for years, and it's just wrong.
We should just fling silver pieces at the enemy.
Well, it's funny. Felden, now, did you play EverQuest 1?
I did not.
Okay. In EverQuest 1, I was a cleric, and clerics had a buff called Agilism, I believe it was called, and it was a huge hit point bonus, but it required a gem to cast it, and this gem, I want to say, I'm just guessing here, I don't remember exactly, it was like 10 gold, and obviously a gold is would be the equivalent of what we have for platinum really today. You can't compare apples to apples when it comes to the economy between the two games. Everybody who had a cleric wanted this spell, and it only lasted 30-some-odd minutes. So I don't know how this all happened, but clerics became what are called master looters. They would loot everything to recoup the costs of this this buff that everybody wanted. And it cost a gem per cast, and you had to cast it on 6 people in the group. So every 30 minutes, you were going through about 60 gold worth of components. For some reason, that didn't map over into EverQuest 2 very well. And, you know, Rangers who are spending their hard-earned money to do what they do and not being not recouping any of the money they are putting into it. Just a very interesting dynamic that somehow didn't translate between the two games.
I've talked to Zelgad, and I've heard the same story over and over is, well, we've looked at the logs, and you're keeping up with the other classes. You're doing the same DPS as the other classes. Like, but they bring so much more to the table. Either we need to be soundly beating them on DPS, but we bring nothing else, or some kind of group buff or hate transfer or something else. I mean, most groups have a courser or an assassin just for the hate transfer.
That is how you kind of build your main tank group 99.9% of the time. And I have to say, too, I've always said you've never heard somebody say, looking for Rangers. You go to any guild that raids website, and if they have open classes, they don't say that they're looking for Rangers.
They'll take us if they can't fill the slot
with something else. And I think, you know, it's a fun class. It's a popular class. But its desirability in a lot of scenarios is low because of that. Like you say, there's nothing else brought to the table.
So what's your number two?
I would say my number two issue with EQ2 right now, which is really causing a lot of disruption, is the mobs dancing around and now teleporting around. And this was a change that was introduced with Velius. And we've never gotten an explanation from mechanics or anyone why this change was made. The minimum melee range for mobs was changed from 2 meters to 5 meters. Now, at first, as a ranger, I was like, oh, this is awesome. I can use all my combat arts, even if the mob is trying to eat my face. I can do spells, I can use arrows, I can use my melee, I can use everything. But then I immediately saw the problem, and that is that the mobs are 5 meters out, they're dancing around, they're going in circles, clockwise, counterclockwise, trying to get to you. And then I logged in my monk, and I really saw the problem, and that's trying to tank these things. Because now you have giants and dinosaurs and whatever else that you're fighting, and they are so far away from you, and you can't get them to follow you into the corner anymore. So they keep trying to patch it. They keep trying to make the mobs not teleport. It goes back to that root problem, which is they changed it from 2 meters to 5 meters, and I think they need to change it back to 2 meters and then just go through all the combat arts and make them have a minimum range of 2 meters. Because right now tanking is, you have guilds that were able to kill certain mobs, and after this change, they can't kill those mobs anymore.
That's got to be a huge problem on raids, when positioning means so much.
Yeah, I can say in our guild, we've certainly seen that problem when we're trying to back a giant into a corner or something. You know, the classic tank and spank maneuver, back him into a corner, have him face the main tank, not facing the raid, that sort of stuff. And these giants, either based on their size or this dance effect that they've got going on, this electric slide, they don't move properly. They'll stand out in the middle of the room, and then they're quick to turn around or something like that. And for me, at least, as soloing as a Templar, the fighting in a circle mechanic that I see doesn't really affect me. The bulk of my DPS comes from my nuking anyways. So I just sit there with my, you know, auto-face target on, and I just kind of sit and spin. and I just keep nuking as I'm spinning. But I can certainly see for fighters, this is a far bigger of a problem. And I can certainly see it on the raid when he's constantly, the main tank is constantly reminding us, hold on, I got to get this thing moved again. He's not coming into the corner correctly. Don't attack yet. I don't have him positioned just yet.
Yeah, the first time I tried to tank a mob with the Velius changes, I mean, I had to run all over the room to get the mob to follow me. It was bizarre.
Do you think this dancing effect, though, is related to also some of the warping that we've seen? Because I've seen mobs all of a sudden, more so than we have in the past, you know, warp between the tank and the fighting force, or you see them over there, and then the next thing you know, they are literally on top of you. They don't run, they don't path.
The warping is a direct result of trying to fix the mob's dancing. So the problem is getting worse instead of better.
Okay.
That's actually a developer said that. And if I can stretch my number two issue with EQ2, I would also say mob targeting is just unbelievable. I started playing 2 weeks after Fadeware came out. And with my Conjurer, that was my first character was a Conjurer. This is great. I send my pet in, and it attacks the mob. And this works all the time. And then 2 weeks later, they released some kind of hotfix or update. You had to be able to draw a straight line from the feet of your pet to the feet of the mob before the pet would be able to attack it. And ever since then, trying to attack something, you have to run all over the place to try to find a place where there's not a bump in the carpet between you and the mob.
There's still a problem with that. Actually, I should say there's a new problem with that in Nectal's Forest. I haven't actually been back lately, but it was still happening around fanfare time. I think it started with Destiny of Velius. You could literally be standing in front of or on top of a mob, and you get the can't see target message and in a seemingly flat area. I have no idea what's going on with that, but it's a huge problem for my characters that are actually trying to level.
I mean, I guess it was done for exploits, you know, because people were pulling mobs through the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've paid too high a price for that fix.
For me, it's extremely frustrating, the lack of line of sight, and I'd call it more line of feet issues.
Yep.
In Kratox on raids, where it's all ramp-based, and I can be 2 steps behind the main tank, but if he's up on the landing and I'm still on the incline, I can't heal him. I can see 99% of him. I just cannot see from his ankles down. And it drives me bonkers and the challenge is in the beginning as a ill-equipped Templar, having to run up those ramps to get into, you know, line of feet puts me in range of AEs that are going off. And I'm getting myself cremated constantly because of it. It was a real challenge in the beginning of trying to time when to run in and heal when he hadn't, say, pulled them far enough back off that ramp so I can just get on the lip of it. Kratox is brutal for that sort of stuff, the ramps and the line of sight issues. Okay, and what is your number one most pressing issue in EverQuest 2 right now?
My number one issue with EQ2 is communication. We used to have developer chats. We used to have Q&A threads. We used to have developer interviews on EverQuest2.com. The communication really has dried up. Now it's just developer posts and webcasts, which are not interactive. The problem I see is that if there's some issue with crafting or some issue with a solo quest or a group quest or anything involving live events, you get a fantastic developer response. The developers are quick to log in and, oh, we're going to fix that, or, oh, this is a problem, you know, especially crafting. You know, oh, yep, this is an issue. We're going to fix it in the next update. Any question regarding mechanics, if you get a response at all, it's days later, weeks later, or not at all. Just we're not, you know, I know class balance is a tricky job, but, you know, we need to have some interaction. We need to know if we're off base, if a fix is coming. So that's my number one issue.
Communication is always a tricky one, I think, because sometimes folks have a tendency, especially players, to read into statements. There's the old adage of reading between the lines. Sometimes we read between the lines, and fill in what we want to hear. And I think I can certainly have that experience as well, coming away from fanfare. I remember walking out of fanfare thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be able to heal on the run. It's going to be like Rowan Thier everywhere now. And healing, casting on the run didn't really pan out the way I thought I heard it. What I heard was you'll be able to cast while moving. What I filled in the blanks for was I'm going to be able to do what I do in Rowan Thier throughout the game. And that's not really what it came out to be. So I can understand where communication can be tricky, because sometimes when we're told stuff, we carry it to an extreme or immediately start to nitpick it if we don't care for it. So sometimes I would imagine that they think the less they say, the better off they are.
Definitely see that. I mean, I think Smokejumper has he writes more. He's the most communicative producer we've had ever, maybe since Hartzman. You know, no question. You know, he does see some of those angles. He'll say, okay, we're not trying to do this. We're trying to do this.
Well, I think too, part of that is it's personality. There are some members of the design team who are better writers than others. And when their primary form of communication is on the forums, there are those on the team who have a far better talent when it comes to posting on the forums and therefore do it more because they're more comfortable with it, and others who will shy away from it. So I think sometimes we see certain aspects of gameplay getting more communication or getting more feedback from names in red than others based on job function and expertise on the team.
I think the interactive part of that is really important, like you were talking about the dev chats. I think if they were to bring those back in some way or do things a little bit more frequently, it wouldn't be quite so, you know, because right now it's sort of like from one fanfare to the next.
Once a year you get your chance to track down a developer in a hallway of a casino hotel and try to have a conversation with them about class balance or some problem with a raid, and once a year is not enough.
My opinion, though, on the dev chats, though, they weren't really chats. They were focused Q&As, but they weren't really discussions. They weren't chats. It wasn't two-way. Questions were asked and they were answered. And to be honest, how many times do we have to say here, are we getting Beast Lords and can we sit in chairs? That seemed to be a staple question of every single one of them.
They got the questions in advance, which takes away some of it, but it just seemed to me there was a little more interaction than a live cast, than a video.
Yes, at least we were able to submit, and they were able to pick their, for lack of better terms, top 10 questions that they wanted to answer or could answer. So even if we had that, even if we had a way, and I think Kiera was doing this at one point on the forum, submit your most pressing issue type questions, and then the team would pick, these are the ones we will answer. So at least you got some answers to questions. Today we throw forum posts out there. We have no idea if they're read or not. Some get traction, some get feedback, others don't. So we don't know. It's kind of like submitting a bug report. We don't know what black hole they are or they are not going into, because we don't get that two-way back.
You know, and so much of that responsibility lies with EQ2 community, with the community team. You know, they have to be the filter. They have to take what we say, sift through it, and then put together reports and pass that on to the developers. They have to know a little bit about the game to understand, okay, this issue is a real issue, this issue is not a big deal, and bringing these issues to the attention of the top people.
So that was a really good Felden angle.
So just to wrap it up, your number three was
Rangers.
And your number two was
Targeting and Mobs Dancing.
And your most pressing issue for EverQuest 2 right now is
communication.
Although, looking back real quickly, number two, that's a little mean. Mobs like to dance. They want to get down with their bad selves. Don't be a hater on them busting a move.
You know, a developer is going to listen to this, and the next update, we're going to have to do a square dance to defeat the mob.
A dance-off. West Side Story style. I can see them coming and snapping. Okay, so did we have anything else for this, our 29th episode of EQ2 Talk?
No, I think that about wraps it up.
All right. So first, let's say a huge thank you for Felden taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us here and chat about EQ2Wire and your take on what's going on in EverQuest 2.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And check me out at EQ2Wire.com. You can find my posts. You can find Death Dealer's awesome posts and also tools that we're working on in the coming months.
And you also have a spot on your website where folks can submit suggestions, comments, that sort of stuff to you?
Absolutely.
We also want to say thank you to this week's corporate sponsor, the Lego Corporation. Play well. And don't forget to check out universe.lego.com for all your Lego MMO needs. And keep an eye out for legommo2talk.com. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, want to talk to us about any of the things that we've been talking about, you can do so in a couple ways. First, you can send us email. So for me, that's delmon@eq2talk.com.
And I'm Allie at eq2talk.com.
You can also catch us in-game. So for me, that's eq2.unrest.delmon, D-E-L-L-M-O-N.
And you can reach me at the same place, Alicious, A-L-I-S-C-I-O-U-S.
And you can reach me at eq2wire.com and click on contact.
You can also join our in-game chat channel, which is eq2.unrest.eq2talk.
And don't forget to check us out over on the Facebook, where we would love for you to like us at facebook.com/eq2talk.
Or follow us on Twitter, which is twitter.com/eq2talk.
We hope to see you all back here for episode 30. And say Soylent Green is people, Allie.
Soylent Green is people, Allie.
Oh, wow, I forgot to hit the record button.
What?
No, just kidding.
Yes, how fast do you type?
80 words a minute.
What's average?
6 inches.
Awesome.
Hunt and peck.
You hunt and peck?
When I'm alone, I hunt and peck.
Oy.
Live from the foot of the Little Mermaid statue in the Copenhagen Harget. Live from the foot of the Little Mermaid. Nobody ever said one take Delmon. We also want to give a big... No, we don't want to give a shout-out because Allie doesn't like shout-outs.
Squirrel.
I was trying to make it sound smart, and the best I could come up with was, so what do you think about Game Update 61?
I was supposed to prepare for this, right?
Yes, you were. We also want to say thank you this week to our corporate sponsor.
Wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen, friendly old girl of the town.
Neath her tavern light on this merry night,
let us drink and drink one glass. To wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen, salty old queen of the sea.
Once I sailed away, but I'm home today.